Everybody, it still seems that not everybody has understood that we have fixed two dates for oral exams. I guess for those who are here and who are usually here, this is already known, but those who are maybe listening only today or so, please contact me soon via email or come to my office to register for at least one of these days if you're interested. Then let's continue physics. Last time we discussed a couple of examples of group theory which are important but still rather simple. There were in particular rotations in three dimensions. The group is called SO3, and also complex rotations in two dimensions which are very similar, and the group name is SU2. And I try to sketch already what the importance of these things is. So whenever two groups have the same algebra, they can be, in a certain sense, combined for physical theory because the objects which transform under these group operations transform in a similar way. And the reason is, the reason for this is that the algebra is the same. And the algebra means that the commutators of the two groups have the same result. So for example, ordinary three-dimensional rotation, when you do a rotation around the x-axis and then around the y-axis, and you do the same operations in the opposite way, then the result or the difference of the two vectors transformed in such a way is a rotation around z. And the same behavior, for example, can be observed for complex SU2 rotations, or also when, I gave you another example, when you write down angular momentum, orbital angular momentum operators in quantum mechanics. So for example, these things are suited to describe rotations, and we have different mathematical objects, three-dimensional real vectors, two-dimensional complex vectors, and wave functions in the case of the orbital angular momentum operators. And since they behave very, very similar because of the same algebra, they can be combined in a proper way. We did not do this, but this will be the goal at the end of this section. In particular, we will derive the Dirac equation in a much more elegant theoretical way. And even so you know the Dirac equation, this is exactly the way to go forward when you would like to understand or derive more complicated theories. So, I told you this quite a couple of times, but this is indeed the main message and the most important thing, which in my opinion is not so easy to understand. Good, so today we start with, we can have more light. Today we start with the most important group in physics, or at least in relativistic physics, in particle physics, which is the Lorentz and the Poincaré group, because any fundamental theory, at least until now, according to our experiments, must be relativistically invariant, and therefore we need to discuss the group structure of Lorentz and Poincaré transformations. So the first items in the script are just the introduction. We know from the previous section about relativistic quantum mechanics that relativistic equations must transform covariantly under Lorentz transformations or also Poincaré transformation. This means nothing else than, for example, the Dirac equation has to have the same form in one inertial system and in another inertial system. When you write down an equation and you transform it and it looks completely different in another inertial system, it's certainly not a good equation to describe relativistic physics, because a fundamental assumption, as I said, which is proven by experiment very precisely, is that everything is invariant under Lorentz transformation, so the physics is the same in every inertial system. Then the next statement I think is also clear. Lorentz transformations and Poincaré transformations form a group. It's easy by just geometrical thinking. When you combine two rotations, you get a third rotation. When you do a boost and another boost, you get a third boost. And also when you combine these things, you don't leave the allowed transformation between inertial systems. So maybe in an even simpler language, when you go from one inertial system to a second and to a third, you could directly go from the first to the third. So obviously we have a group, so we can or should be able to apply our formalism. And combining the first two statements that we can formulate the transformations in terms of group theory, and the first statement that all equations must have the same form under these operations shows or explains why the Lorentz and the Poincaré group are so important in physics. The Poincaré group is just an extension of the Lorentz group, which adds translations. So we start first with the Lorentz group. And half of the Lorentz group we have already discussed, because the Lorentz group, as you know, consists of rotations and of boosts. So the rotations are nothing else than the group SO3. Generators of rotations. See section 5-1. We spoke about the group SO3, and now Lorentz transformations are 4x4 matrices, and the corresponding generators, or one of the generators, JX, has the following form. Here are just zeros, and here in this 3x3 matrix structure we have -1 and +1 and everything else. When I don't write something, it's a zero. So basically, what we discussed about SO3, you find in this lower 3x3 block, which is not surprising, I think, because you know from relativity that the rotations only affect the spatial components of the four vectors. And this is, of course, not the full rotation. It's only the generator. So you need to multiply this one with an infinitesimal parameter and add it to the identity. So basically, this is, represents the small correction by the sinus in the rotation matrix. This is also the next point. I think I don't need to write down JY and JZ. You can look it up in the script. And the next thing is, I think, also a repetition. We have infinitesimal rotations of the following form: lambda mu nu equal 1 plus I alpha j j, infinitesimal rotations around j axis, and as before, finite rotations are not very difficult. It's always the same thing. You need to put I parameter times generators in the exponent. So then we have lambda mu nu equal e to the power of I alpha jj when you rotate around the j-axis. So this is more a repetition of what we did last time. I think this should be clear unless you have questions about the last two lectures. Now, also what follows is nothing new, at least not conceptually. What's missing now are the generators of boosts. And as you'll see in a minute, it's much more convenient not to use beta or the velocity as a boost parameter, but the rapidity. And since I guess you're not using so often, or it's not so common to use the rapidity for you, I'll repeat this. More convenient than using velocity v is using rapidity adder, and this is defined in the following way: sinus superbolicus of adder equal gamma beta, yeah, where gamma and beta are the usual things. Beta is v over c, and gamma is 1 over 1 minus beta square root. Yeah, and from this definition, it immediately follows that cosine hyperbolicus of eta is just gamma, or you could also define it vice versa, taking cosinus eta is gamma as the definition, and then the sine hyperbolicus relation follows. why are we doing this? Now, the advantage is the following rapidities are additive. Remember, I'm quite sure that you did in your previous theory lectures when you first discussed relativity an exercise where you had to derive the equation for adding two velocities in relativity. And this was not just boost 1 and boost 2 is velocity v1 plus v2. It was a complicated equation. And for rapidities, this is not complicated. When we boost with rapidity eta 1 and then with eta 2, the resulting boost matrix, which combines both boosts, is just with rapidity eta 1 plus eta 2. I think the main reason for this is when we have a boost matrix in terms of velocities or gamma and beta, it looks like this gamma, beta, gamma, beta, gamma, 1, 1. And with beta equal v over c and gamma is this one. Now, the reason why you can write sinus and cosine instead of gamma and gamma times beta is the following. When you do as an exercise gamma square, now I have to think the addition theorem with cosine hyperbolicus is, I think, with a minus. Hope I get it right. When you compute this, or when you insert the expression for gamma here and here, and beta here, and you simplify it, you get 1. And you have cosine hyperbolicus square minus sine hyperbolicus square is also 1, right? This is one of the, I would say, generalizations of the normal addition theorem, cosinus square plus sinus square is 1, with hyperbolicus it's a minus. And because the quantities gamma and beta are only related in that way, it makes sense to define or to parameterize the gamma by cosine hyperbolicus and the gamma square beta by sine hyperbolicus. So this only explains for the moment why it's possible to parameterize it by a single parameter in that way, which by the way must be the case. Gamma and beta are not independent. They both are functions of beta and of the velocity. And the other question which remains, and which is probably a bit deeper, why is this useful? And here the answer is that the rapidities are additive. And in any case, you can, of course, check it by writing the Lorentz transformation as cosine hyperbolicus eta sine hyperbolicus and cosine hyperbolicus, and multiply two of the boost matrices together, then you find a third one of the same form, where the argument is eta 1 plus eta 2 here and here. But this is just checking the statement, giving a good argument why one could expect maybe in advance that this is good. Not 100% sure. And you could, of course, say for rotations, I know that angles work quite well. And in relativity, time and space is only differing by a minus sign in the metric, but it's very, very similar. And then you play a little bit around, or for example, what people did in the old days in relativity, they didn't use the Minkowski metric. They multiplied the time with a factor of I. And for example, when you insert this factor of I wherever the zero component of a four vector, the time component appears, I think you can show that cosinus of a complex argument is a cosine hyperbolicus of a real argument or so. So maybe this gives a hint that these hyperbolicus functions are a good idea to parameterize boost matrices. Does this answer your question? By the way, it's, I think, a good question. When I saw it for one of the first times as a student, I found it also very surprising why suddenly making the jump from the common gamma and beta to such weird things, why does this work? But I think this one is the important thing, why you can do it. Without this relation, it wouldn't make any sense to use cosine of sine. Then you would get inconsistencies. Okay, so this is a main point for rapidities, they are additive. In other words, I have it in words in my script. When you boost by eta 1 and eta 2, then it's the same as you boost once with eta 1 plus eta 2 rapidity. And here, I already wrote down the next line, but since it's important, I will copy it again and write it more carefully. Boost with rapidity eta in x direction lambda mu nu equal plus cosine hyperbolicus eta plus sine hyperbolicus eta and plus sine hyperbolicus eta plus cosine hyperbolicus eta 1, 1 and rest is 0. And now we are interested to get the generators, the corresponding things to the Jx, Jy, and Jz. And for infinitesimal rapidity eta, we can just replace the cosine hyperbolicus by 1 and the sine hyperbolicus by eta, because the Taylor expansion, not sure whether you remember, but it's very similar, like the ordinary sinus and cosine. Here for the cosine hyperbolicus, it's 1 plus, 1 over 6 eta square, 1 plus order eta square, and the sine hyperbolicus, the leading order is just eta. And having written down this, we can immediately read off the infinitesimal form and the generators. So lambda mu nu is 1 plus I infinitesimal rapidity, and now we call the generator k instead of j, because we would like to distinguish it from the rotations. And kx has the minus I, which is just a convention and goes away with this I. And now we can read off from this form, wherever the eddas are, we need to put a 1. So it's plus 1, 0, 0, and here everywhere 0. And I think you have it in the script. It's very straightforward. Maybe I put down ky on the board. Ky has a plus 1 here and a plus 1 here. And kz, as you see, it's here in the corner. I think it's almost obvious, or if not, it's a good small exercise for you to do in the afternoon. This is, I would say, very straightforward, even a bit boring, just bookkeeping. What's now interesting is now the next thing. We have now the full set of generators. We have 6 generators, and we know from our past experience from mechanics and electrodynamics that we have 6 parameters, 3 boost velocities, 3 angles. So we have the full set of generators, and now we can calculate the algebra of the Lorentz group. And the algebra, as I told you in the last lectures already, is the most important thing, because the 4x4 matrices, we have now on the board are only 1 possible representation, but later when you would like to construct relativistic theories, we will be looking for other representations of the same algebra. For example, the Dirac spinor is one of these representations, which is looking completely different. Remember, we had a very hard time in deriving the transformation law under boosts and under rotations of a spinor. And once we understand this, we can construct the Dirac equation and immediately get the transformation law of spinors as a representation of the Lorentz algebra, which we'll now write down or calculate in a minute. So from the generators JJ and KJ, one can calculate the Lorentz algebra, and it looks like this: JJ, JK equal I epsilon JKL, JL. This is not new. This is what we had already from SO3, from rotations. the ordinary angular momentum algebra is obviously part of the Lorentz algebra. Then nu are commutators which contain the boost generators kj, kk equal minus I epsilon j kl jl. So differences are minus, and also that exchanging the order of two boosts gives not a third boost, but it gives a rotation again. This is, by the way, quite interesting also to study graphically, and I think the sheet I uploaded yesterday in the evening contains a couple of very simple exercises where your task is to draw such things. So you could, for example, think a bit what happens when you boost in one direction and in the second direction, or when you boost in the second direction at the beginning and in a second step, and then you can convince yourself that you have a rotation around one of the other axes as determined by epsilon. Yeah, and the third commutator needs also to be calculated, what happens when I exchange rotation and boost. And it also looks somewhat similar. So exchanging rotation and boost gives another boost. This, I think, is maybe even the geometrically simplest and most obvious of the commutators, because when you boost in one direction and then rotate the system, and you first rotate the system and boost then, in a certain sense, the directions somewhere apart, so it's not so surprising that a boost appears. But again, I think when you do this sheet, maybe you can extend it a bit if you're interested in these things by also trying to figure out or understand this in a geometric way. The calculation, of course, is easy. You really just need to take the matrices we have put on the board or in the script and compute the commutators, and then you have these things. And indeed, what's now here is very important. It's the main result of this section about Lorentz and Poincaré transformations, because these commutators, as I said already many times, they basically describe the group. Okay, so before we move on to the Poincaré group, I give you already now a second representation of the same algebra. Yeah, similar, like we had three different representations as examples for the group of rotations. Another representation is also something we had, or an extension of what we had already. The generators for rotations are written as epsilon j kl x k minus I dl. So what is it what I have written down now? Angular momentum operators, exactly. And yeah, since boosts and rotations are very similar, it's, I think, reasonable to expect that a very similar combination, probably now containing the time coordinate and not only the space coordinate, works to fulfill this algebra. And when you play around a little bit, you'll find that time multiplied with spatial derivative and space multiplied with time derivative with these signs, the signs you maybe need to try until you find a solution, but sysing fulfills what's there. So as a general tip, whenever you want to extend a spatial thing, rotations or whatever, to the relativistic thing, the answer doesn't look very different. Usually it's only factors of I or factors of minus which have to be exchanged. And as you see, it's exactly the same structure as here, because in, it looks at the first glance that this is one term and here are two terms. But of course, when you get rid of the implicit sum here, we have a sum over k and over l for fixed j. So for given j, we have, for example, j equal 1, we have the possibility here to have k equal 2 and l equals 3, or k equals 3 and l equal 2. So also two terms where the indices are just exchanged, and this is exactly what we see here. So what you should take away from this item here is, first of all, there are many representations of this very important algebra, and second, we'll need this later. Therefore, I thought it's a good point to put it already on the board here. Okay, so the section 5.3 was Lorentz and Poincaré group, so let's extend what we did to the Poincaré group. So the Poincaré group is, even though usually one speaks about the Lorentz group, the fundamental and full group describing relativity is the Poincaré group. The Poincaré group contains the Lorentz group plus additional operation, namely translations either in space or in time. So we have four more parameters, but typically people consider mostly the Lorentz group because these translations do not give very interesting physics or quite often automatically included in what we are doing, but nevertheless, since we are studying group theory now, we should at least once do the full thing and not only the most important subgroup, the Lorentz group. So it's Lorentz plus translations in time in space, but when we think about how to extend what we did above, we mainly studied 4x4 matrices acting on a 4-vector, and I think it's clear that by a multiplication with a matrix, you can never represent a translation. A translation is something different. With multiplications, with matrix multiplication, you can do rotations, you can do a shearing, you can do a scaling, but you can never translate a vector. Not sure whether you saw it in mathematics in linear algebra, but if not, try to represent this operation x mu goes to x mu plus a constant a mu in the following way, that you write this one as a 4 by 4 matrix times x mu, and you will see this is not possible. So why am I writing this down? Now, probably the natural thing we would have done or like to do is to take these six generators with 4 by 4 matrices and write down 4 more generators, 4 more 4 by 4 matrices giving infinitesimal translations. And then we would have the generators of the translations in time and space, and then we could easily work out the Lorentz, the Poincaré algebra. But as I said, the 4 by 4 representation, it's not possible to generate such translations. Therefore, we need to use another representation where this is possible. And this is precisely or one of the reasons why I gave you this example here. This representation is not a matrix representation. It contains x, and it contains derivatives. And as we will see in a minute, with such a representation, we can generate translations in time and space. So let me conclude this point. Not possible with 4 by 4 matrices. But with representation, the scripted equation 279. Yeah, and we have seen this before already, I think even in the last lecture. When I showed you that this generates indeed rotations of a function, and the same idea or mathematics we are going to do now. Let's consider the translation of a function phi of x mu in time by a constant a mu, a zero. And yeah, we can do this in the following way. Phi of x zero plus a zero, this is a time component, and the three spatial components. This can be written in the following way: j equals 0 to infinity, a 0 to the power of j factorial of j d phi over d 0. There again, typos in the script must be the j's derivative and evaluated at x0 and x. So this is nothing else than the Taylor expansion of the function phi at expansion point x0. And typically the small parameter when you stop the Taylor series at some point A, but when you go to infinity, it holds basically for arbitrary A0. So we had a very similar thing for rotations, as I said already. Okay, and now, since we have such a translation, let's consider infinity. The infinitesimal version, again, we have 0, x0 plus a0, and a spatial argument of x. A0 is now the infinitesimal thing, and then what we can do is, of course, abort after the first order, and then we have something like 1 plus I A0 P0 phi of x0 and x with P0 equal minus I D0. So it looks a bit different, but it's nothing else than stopping this sum at j equal 1. And this here is a j equal 1 term when you insert this definition, minus I D0. Yeah, perhaps you have already seen this before. You can, in a certain sense, translate the function by using the derivative operator. Again, I said it already 2 times, like you can generate rotations by using the derivative in the angle. This is what we showed or did last time. And I define the P0 because these equations here are generators of a specific representation of the Lorentz group, and P0 is now also a generator of the same representation. So P0, JJ, and KJ, they belong together. And same thing, of course, we could do for spatial translations. And I think we don't need to repeat everything. We need to add the parameter A to one of the spatial coordinates, write again down a Taylor expansion, and then you find 3 more generators, namely Pj equal minus I Dj. Yeah, so these are the 10 generators of the Lorentz group, of the Poincaré group. In a specific representation, one should maybe add. But at least we now have a representation of the 10 generators. And yeah, this is very important for us because now we can, in a straightforward way, calculate the algebra again or extend the algebra from above. This is the main reason why we did it now. Can now calculate the Poincaré algebra. From these generators. Yeah, and what we find is, of course, the Lorentz algebra, because we have 6 of our generators are the same, namely J and K. And then we need to study all commutators which contain at least one of the translations, or also 2. And yeah, this is also a straightforward calculation. I mean, we have space and time coordinates and derivatives with respect to the space and time coordinate. And yeah, like in ordinary quantum mechanics, for example, when you first calculated the commutator of X and P, you can do similar things. And what you find is P mu equals zero. J P zero equals zero. J PK equal plus I epsilon J KL PL KJ P0 equal minus I PJ and KJ PK equal minus I delta JK P0. Good. So so in total the Poincaré algebra is given by everything within a brown box. And I would say the Poincaré and the Lorentz algebra, even though they are very similar and used in a similar context, both are extremely important. What I don't expect in the exam is that you remember, of course, all the signs from the algebra. But what you should remember is maybe the crude structures, with exception of signs or so. Many of these commutators are very logical. For example, when I ask you what is a commutator of a translation in x and y direction, I mean you don't need a real calculation, just thinking. When I shift something in x and then in y, or do it first in y and then in x, there's no difference, which is why there's a zero. Or what else do we have? When we shift something in time, so do it in 5 minutes, namely a rotation, or when we rotate now and then wait for 5 minutes, this must also be the same thing, therefore a zero. It's different when we shift in space. When we shift something and rotate it, it's different than we rotate it and then shift it. Again, the homework hopefully makes this a bit clearer, and my advice is, yeah, try to get a geometrical picture of the rough structure of these things in your head. Then I think you understood everything which is necessary, and whenever you need it, you can look at my script or any book or so, and you find all the details. So before we go to the break, a question to you. Here I told you that 4x4 matrices are not good to derive the Poincaré algebra. But you know, or we know, that 4x4 matrices lambda are certainly very important for relativity, and it's definitely not the case that 4x4 matrices are not a representation of the Poincaré algebra. So my question to you is now, what kind of matrices, of 4x4 matrices, do I have to choose to fulfill also these commutators here? And why are those matrices not very useful to derive the algebra? It sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. And when you understand it, I think you understood better what I did or why I went to this other representation. It's a very, very simple answer. Don't think complicated. What set of 4x4 matrices fulfills these complicated relations? J and K are fixed. It's only a question, or only remaining freedom is for p. What can I use for p such that all these equations are fulfilled? It's a 4x4 matrix which contains only zeros, because everywhere on the commutators you have at least one p, and on the right hand side you have either zero or also a p. So when you insert only zeros, you have a solution. And this is exactly the 4x4 representation of the Poincaré algebra. Basically, what it means when you have, for example, a four vector could be, think about electromagnetism, the four potential A mu. When you rotate it, the four vector rotates. When you boost the vector, it somehow stretches or that transforms. But when you translate the electromagnetic four potential, nothing happens. From here to here, the vector points in the same direction, which is consistent, which we just said, that yeah, you can write down a representation of the Poincaré algebra, but nothing happens to the four vectors, which is not a bad thing. It's a valid representation, but of course, it's not useful to use such a representation to get the algebra, because when we commute zeros with zeros, yeah, we get only zeros, not an interesting result, but still, when we have the interesting result, the zero matrices fulfill it. So maybe think in the 5 minutes break about this, and we continue at 11:16. Oh, now we have all the basics, but it was a bit boring or not much relation to physics, because we basically did group theory with some physical context, but we didn't derive any interesting physics result. And now we are trying to do this in the next section. 5.4, construction of relativistic wave and field equations based on symmetries. So as I said already, we are not deriving in this section new equations. Our goal will be a bit more modest. At the end, we will derive the Dirac equation in a much more general and elegant way. And when you understand this, you have all the tools and necessary things that you derive your own whatever models or theories which are useful relativistic theories. For example, when you're working in physics beyond the standard model, where you need to guess new models, or when you would like to describe some complicated thing, nuclear physics or so, which is still relativistic but which you cannot fully solve based on fundamental theories, these techniques are very useful. Or also, I said it last, at the end of the last lecture, when you, for example, would like to understand why we have four fundamental forces and why the Lagrangian or equations of motions of these forces look like they look, then this gives the answer. So in my opinion, it's very interesting section, but it's also a very abstract and complicated section. So yeah, it's really a challenge, and maybe you need a couple of whatever days or weeks to digest it, and anytime try to ask. I found it very complicated as a student, but when I understood it, I was extremely happy and find it still very nice and very beautiful thing in mathematics and physics. So first thing, wave functions and fields. We know basically from Dirac equation for Maxwell equations or whatever you have seen in your life as a physicist that wave functions and fields can have many components. So this is not a deep statement, as an introduction. For example, the Dirac spin or psi has four components, psi 1 to psi 4. Or when you think not about wave equations but field equations, think about the four potential from electrodynamics. Also here, just by coincidence, now you have four components. But this is the main message, and I think this is what is very well known. You could have equations with functions or fields which have many components. The new thing from the big section about group theory and symmetries is now that such objects with many components must transform under Poincaré trafos in a very specific way. So see what we just did, the algebra. I hope that this last sentence, it's not trivial, that you meanwhile at least partly understand what it means. For example, when we have an object with four components, for example, the psi or the a or anything else, when we do a translation and another translation, and we exchange these two translations, there may not be a difference in the transformation of the whole thing. Why? Because of this commutator here. This one says that translations can be interchanged. When, for example, you decide for some object and some transformation law where this thing is not fulfilled, it's obviously not a valid representation of the Poincaré group. And we have many such commutators. This was a very simple one. We really need to find a representation of this Poincaré group. A very simple one is, I mean, simple not because it's simpler than the others, but because you know it very well, is the ordinary four-vector A mu. You're very used to the ordinary four-vector A mu, and you know what kind of representation or transformation law this representation has, namely the standard lambda mu nu matrices. You learn in relativity, and for translations, what I just said before the break, nothing happens to A mu because the P mu in 4x4 form are just zero matrices. You also know from the section about relativistic quantum mechanics the transformation law of a spinor. This was or seems much more complicated because it's new. But there are, of course, many, many, an infinite number of objects with each has maybe different components, and you can find suitable transformations which fulfill this algebra. And only such things, single or multi-component objects which transform according to the algebra are valid building blocks for relativistic theory. Or in other words, before we can start building theories, writing down equations, we need to find representations. And when we have these representations, then we can think about how to combine it, for example, to get a Lorentz invariant action or a Lorentz form invariant equation of motion. So this is at least to some extent clear, or when it's completely confusing, then ask again, it's harder stuff here, it's nothing simple. It's a big step you're going to do as a physicist. Until now, people gave you equations and you just solved them. Now it's very abstract thinking about fundamental symmetries, which equations are useful and allowed equations. It's really a completely new point of view, but a very powerful one. So don't feel ashamed to ask or so when it's not clear. Yeah, in the script I have a lot of text also to explain it. I'm not going to write it down. I try to translate it in English. This I already put on the board. Such objects must transform under Poincaré trafos in a consistent way. And consistent means it has to fulfill the properties of the Poincaré algebra here, and what I wiped out, the Lorentz algebra, of course, also. And then I give examples. For example, the commutator of Jx and Jy equal plus iz, which is which means a rotation around the y-axis and around the z-axis differs from a rotation around the x-axis and then around the y-axis, and this difference corresponds to a rotation around z. So such a property must be fulfilled by any allowed representation which we can use as a field or a wave function in our relativistic equations. Or I put another example, but basically you can put any commutator you would like. Two boosts gives a rotation, and so on, and so on. So first of all, we need representations of these things, and until we have not found such things, we cannot start. This is always the first step to construct such a thing. Yeah, and this is also the last statement. The first task is find matrix representations of the Poincaré algebra, and the n by n representations you find correspond to n component wave functions or n component fields, which can be used as building blocks for series, and the corresponding n by n matrices fix the transformation law of these n component wave functions or fields. So basically what I said before is written down in maybe another or very similar way. So those of you who speak German should really study this half page in detail in the afternoon. And the few of you who don't speak German, maybe Google Translate helps and boosts also your German language skills at the same time. Good. Now, I told you we, in principle, know already two such representations, but this is now not the point. What I would like to do in the remainder of this lecture and at the beginning of the next one, let's go step by step by step through the construction of such components, and let's start very, very simple. You will see there are extremely trivial representations which are also allowed. And this is, by the way, when you try to derive the four fundamental forces of nature or the standard model, you write down the most simple things you have, and yeah, basically then you find electromagnetism, strong interactions, relativity, and weak interactions. So nature is very nice to us. Starting with very simple objects quickly leads to success. And yeah, we start very simple, namely with one component. In the script, I always write wave functions and fields just to keep what I have to write on the board short. The following, I just say wave functions because it's a lecture about quantum mechanics, but it's meant to be wave functions and fields. A one-component representation is maybe so simple that it's complicated again, or that you're confused why we need this formalism. But pedagogically, it's good because you see you can really start simple. There's only a single 1 by 1 matrix representation. Namely, J equals 0 is a 1 by 1 matrix, a number, and KJ equals 0. And when we include the Poincaré group, which I didn't do in this script, it's also PJ equals 0. So it's a bit ridiculous, of course, what's now on the board, but it's valid. Think about the commutators. When you insert zeros everywhere, it's fulfilled. And yeah, what does it mean? First of all, it's a 1 by 1 matrix. It acts on a one component wave function. Let's call it, yeah, the typo in the script, phi and psi are mixed. Let's call it phi. And you can immediately write down, since we have found a representation, now what happens when we, for example, do a boost, e.g. boost with rapidity adder, then the boosted wave function psi prime is in the usual way exponential of I adder, and then the generator of the corresponding operation of the boost in x direction times phi. Maya, but this one is very simple, it's zero. So for any boost parameter, this is the identity. And the result is phi prime is phi. And also this is, of course, not a very deep statement or any new knowledge we are gaining, but it shows that the most simple thing which you had, for example, in the ordinary Schrödinger equations, this is not relativistic, but in the Klein-Gordon equation, namely a scalar field, a one-component field. And what happens when you boost it? Nothing happens. You have only one component, and I guess you heard the name scalar before in physics, or scalar means it doesn't change under transformation. But now, in a very formal way, we showed that there is a representation in terms of 1 by 1 matrices acting on one component functions, which fulfills the algebra and which gives a transformation law, which I guess we immediately accept and remember that we have used it before. So one would say Lorentz scalar and an example is the Klein-Gordon equation. Or when you think about the standard model, the only scalar particle we have, but there's one scalar particle and it's a Higgs boson. There you also need this representation. So, if you wouldn't have heard anything about four vectors, we would continue now with the next simple thing. We would now think, are there 2x2 matrix representations? But since you know very well four vectors, it's probably a bit simpler to understand. Therefore, we jump from one to four components, and only then in a 2 minutes or so, we go back to two components. So for component fields, basically, you know everything about this. It's just to complete the list. Known example is the four potential A mu with JJ and KJ as in several equations 270, 272, 276, and 277. So the 4x4 generators, which we actually derived from the known Lorentz transformation lambda mu nu. And the only, not really new thing, but maybe not so common thing, is lambda mu nu, the Lorentz transformation, which you'd usually wrote as a 4x4 matrix, can now be expressed in a very compact form. You can write it as exponential of 4x4 generators in the following way, alpha j, 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 plus eta j, k, j. And yeah, these are the angles, and these are the rapidities. So when you plug in the J's and the K's and you simplify this, you are back. It's a used form, but this is a very general and also a form in the same structure as you'll always use now. For example, this one is the same structure as that one, and it holds for any matrix representations as soon as we have found J and K. And this one here, we have A prime mu equal lambda mu nu A nu. One second. Let me highlight this one in color and also this one in color. Maybe this helps you again to see that the mathematical structure is the same. The only complicated thing is or was to find the generators, but as soon as you have any matrix representation of 4x4 or 20x20 or whatever generators, you're immediately able to write down the transformation law and the Lorentz transformations. And I think those two on the board are those which were used or which you knew before you came this semester to the quantum mechanics 2 lecture, and now we are going to new things 2x2, which brings us again to spin, and you could extend it to any matrix size. For any matrix size, or almost any size, you'll be able to find representations. 20x20 was not a joke. It's probably a particle with a very high spin or so, which you construct then, but it's mathematically possible. It just doesn't seem to be realized in nature. But you had a question. Yes, yeah, I would even say the generators J and K are representation of the Lorentz or Poincaré group, yes. And this is then the general equation to use the generators to make a finite transformation.
And the reason that BJ doesn't appear there, is it because it's zero for all the elements?
Yes, it's exactly. For any matrix representation, I think it's coming a bit later in the script. It's what I asked to you just before the break. For any matrix representation, the P's are not anymore on the board. These are the generators of the translations in space and time are zero. So it's maybe a bit of a lazy notation. We could add, let's call it A, I don't know how we did it, A mu, P mu or so, but P mu is anyway for any matrix representation just a zero. So what I say now about the Lorentz group can be trivial, extended to the Poincaré group, and I just want to save a bit of space. But it's a good question. Good for understanding that, yeah, not aware of any example which is Lorentz but not Poincaré invariant or cannot be trivially extended to the Poincaré group, but to be 100% sure or mathematically correct or have a very precise language, use the Poincaré, not just the Lorentz group. Also here, I think I haven't had it in the script, but I put it on the board. Pj equals zero is very simple, and yeah. This equation, I made an example, but also here the general form would be basically a copy of what's down there. This formula of the equation is blind to the representation. It's I, what is it, alpha j, kj, not k, jj plus eta j, kj plus a mu, p mu or so. It always looks the same. This is the powerful thing of what we are doing now. Finding a representation of an algebra is, I think I said it a week or so ago, it's not easy when you do it analytically, but it can be linearized and given to a computer algebra program. So when you have maybe 2 or 4 weeks time and understand it better, you could write a code which automatically finds or produces all representation up to whatever matrix size, 50x50 or so. And immediately you have the corresponding transformation matrices, which are already complicated for 4x4, but once you have the generators, write down this, yeah, J general equation which doesn't depend on what kind of representation you're using, and you immediately have the Lorentz transformation on such a complicated object.
The Lambda mu obviously has two open indices, mu and mu. So how does it work that our equation with the generators doesn't have any open indices?
Yeah, also this was maybe a bit sloppy, so I mean, what I wanted to say, lambda is a 4x4 matrix, and the 4x4 matrix is given by Z1. If you prefer, I wipe out this, not because it's wrong, but otherwise it's not readable. We could put it in brackets and make indices mu nu here. Or one, even though it's uncommon, we could also eliminate on both sides the indices. So yeah, I think this inconsistency in a certain sense, or this notation, is used quite often. We also wrote before, or in electrodynamics, lambda mu nu equal a 4x4 matrix, which is strictly speaking also not correct. At the end of the 4x4 matrix, I would need to put the indices again, but yeah, this is in a certain sense quite often, I think also in the literature, not done. But principally you're correct. A very strict notation should have the same number of indices both on the left and on the right side. We are almost over time. What we are now doing in the next lecture on Tuesday, we are studying two component fields, and what one finds is that a possible representation is given by the Pauli matrices in this way here. So you could already check as a homework that this choice fulfills the algebra. It's not so surprising because the algebra, when you remember, was essentially the angular momentum algebra. Also for the case had a couple of minuses or i's. So it's not so surprising that, I mean, for J, you know it already. We had this as an example of SU2. And for K, playing with the sign or with the prefactor, that such a thing can be found. And I think you can immediately already guess what this is, what we have found here. The sigmas always indicate what, namely spin, or what's usually called spin, and what we understand is a spin 1/2 particle. And basically, this is a representation of a massless spin 1/2 particle, what is now on the board and which we'll discuss next time. But there are a couple of subtleties. For example, it's not the only representation. There's another one with a minus, and not sure whether you had particle physics before. There are two types of spin 1/2 massless particles, namely left and right-handed ones. One is realized in nature as a neutrino. The other one is not realized, basically. I'm not sure. I guess the answer is not known, or at least I don't know it. But you see that these group series stuff already brings us very quickly to interesting physics, which is also part of nature. But yeah, as I said, I just wanted to tell you how we are continuing towards now really interesting things. And yeah, this we are going to do next Tuesday.